It's a great pleasure to introduce the third speaker of this session, Xavier Benet. Xavier really doesn't need an introduction. I think all of you know him. Xavier is a research investigator in India with the AskPPO's team. And he has really led the way over 10 years now. He has taught us all how to perform nonlinear statistics on manifolds, both for computational anatomy and for diffusion tensor imaging. He has certainly pioneered the log Euclidean distances that we, or many of us, use right now. So I think he's going to overview some of his work related to both PTI and computational anatomy.
Thank you very much, Christos, for this very nice introduction, and thank you also for the organizer to invite me to try to explain some of the work we are doing on that aspect. So, all over the week, you heard about computational anatomy and statistics and manifolds, and the goal of this presentation is to try to give you a little more insight of what are the methods that we can use on manifold and how actually we can compute and how we can construct and use a kind of algorithmical framework to realize this program. So we'll try to do that in a more tutorial way and then perhaps speed up a little bit more at the end to give a few new results. Okay, so first thing I'd like to do is to broaden a little bit the word or computational anatomy. So as you heard over several talks this week, the goal of computational anatomy is to it's not just to compute deformations. It's more from the applied point of view to design algorithm to model and to analyze the anatomy, so to compute mean values, what is the representative shape, but also what is the variability, how it evolves over time. And there are two main type of applications. One is more from the neuroscientific point of view. It's to discover how shapes of the anatomy are, what are the differences between groups. And there's also a second type of application which is more in the field of medical image analysis where I come from, which is what can we extract from this information about the variability? Can we use that as a kind of prior to help diagnosis or to help actually computer-aided medicine? And here's the way we can see that. At the individual level for a given subject or patient, we have some image signals, any type of information. And what we would like to do is to first try to normalize all this information at the population level to discover what's happening, what makes two populations different. So that's the first step here of the statistical analysis, which is actually discovering what are the differences. Then there is a second step, which is how can we interpret these differences? Can we model them? And if we can model them, then we can create generative models that will be used in turn to help personalizing new data coming for a given patient. So I will try to give you examples at the end. So it's for me, computational anatomy has to be seen from both this point of view. At the population level, discovering, but then reusing this knowledge to help the interpretation of individual data. Okay, so what are the methods? So if we have a look at these four cortex, the way we can try to see what is common and what is different is usually by extracting some kind of landmarks. And the landmarks can be classified by their dimensionality, for instance, so they could be anatomical landmark or functional landmark. This could be curves. So I will show you an example with circle lines. It could be surfaces. So we've seen a very nice example on for instance, yesterday with a talk of Maxime Boucher. This could be images, so we've seen a talk on VBM. Could be transformations, so that there was the talk of Natasha and on tensor-based morphometry. So all this this thing is, we have some kind of features, we're trying to put them into group-wise correspondence, and when we, then we want to do statistics. And the key thing is that these objects are generally not belonging to a Euclidean distance, a Euclidean space, but rather to a manifold. So for instance, if you take very simple things like unit vectors, you have measurement on the sphere, and if you just try to compute the mean value, that would be a point which will be inside the sphere and not on the sphere. And so you can always think of reprojecting, but what's happening for more complex things, for instance, rotations. So if you're averaging Urey angles or unit quaternions, it will give you different results. So the key question is how to develop some kind of consistent way of computing a manifold. And it turns out that the most powerful framework is Riemannian geometry. So that will be the overview of my talk. I will first present Riemannian geometry, what we can do with that, how we can do statistics with that, and with example on rigid body transformation and tensors. And then in the second part of the talk, I will come back to computational neural anatomy. Okay, so we heard several times about manifolds, on Riemannian manifolds. So I will try to give you just a very quick overview of what is interesting and why it is an interesting structure. So manifold, you can think of this is something which is locally flat, but globally curved. So basically, you can see it as a sphere. This is a good manifold. And if you take 2 points here, you can see that the tangent vectors at these 2 points cannot be compared. So this is the basis of the Riemannian geometry. If we want to be able to measure, for instance, the length of this vector, then we need a scalar product on this tangent space. But there's no reason why this scalar product should be the same in another tangent space, because we're not in the same space. So the basics of Riemannian geometry is to provide a tangent a dot product at each tangent space so that we can measure the length of vectors at each point. So now if we have a curve, then we can measure, we can compute the tangent vector to the curve, measure its length, and by integrating, measure the length of this curve. So now we have the tool to measure length on manifold, and basically we can the geodesics can be defined as the curves which minimize the length between any 2 points. So there is also another way to define geodesics, which is by minimizing the energy, which is the integral of the squared norm of the tangent vector. So for the some of the manifold that I will talk about, we will have an explicit solution for the geodesics, but for the diffeomorphism, for instance, you saw on Tuesday that there is some optimization, but this can be computed. And on surfaces, we can also compute some geodesics. So the key thing is, if we have a way to compute the geodesic, that will be the first step to compute on manifold. Okay, the second tool that we will need is what is called the exponential and log maps. So what is that? It's nothing very fancy. If you think of a point on the manifold and you try to unfold the manifold on the tangent space, to unroll the manifold along the geodesics, in that case, this geodesic here becomes this straight line, and the length along this geodesic with respect to the development point is conserved. So this is one of the most powerful tools, and basically, so what we call the exponential is take a tangent vector and go along the geodesic that starts at this point with this tangent vector for unit time. And the log map is the reverse. And these two operations are really the basics of computing on manifolds. And One example is the following. If you think about actually in a vector space, usually we are adding, subtracting. But normally when you think about points, we are not in a vector space but in a Euclidean space. So adding two points have no meaning. You can add a vector to points. You can do the difference between two points, which is a vector, which is in this case here, the difference between point y and x would be the tangent vector that starts from x to y. And the difference is that the vector here is pointed. It is belonging to a tangent space at a given point. So the xy, the vector xy, is in this tangent space, and the vector yx is in the tangent space at y. So that's the only difference. We have vectors which are pointed, and we can reinterpret things. So the difference here would be the log. And here, if we think about adding a vector to a point, that's exactly starting from this point and going a little bit along the geodesy. So that's basically the exponential map. Then we can do some kind of more fancy thing like gradient descent. Gradient descent is nothing like you have a criterion, you compute the direction in which you optimize best, and you go a little bit along that. So that's following the gradient, following the geodesic that starts at the current point with a given tangent vector. So this is these are the basic tools that we need to implement. Basically, the idea is that if you have an implementation of the exponential and log map, even by optimization, then you will be able to do all I will show you in the following. Okay, there are a few more restrictions. You need to have the manifold which is geodesically complete or thing like that, but I will skip that if you're interested. I can explain that to you at the end. Okay, so now how to do statistics. So as I'm French, I will start not from statistics, but from probabilities, which is the mathematical way to do in France for the theory. And the idea is, so to go in probability, we don't have samples, we have distributions. And to define distributions, we need to have a measure, a reference measure. And the neat thing is that the Riemannian metric is giving us a Riemannian measure. This is basically, if you take orthogonal vectors in a tangent space, this defines a unit volume. This is the measure that we can use as a reference. And with respect to this reference, we can define intrinsic probability density functions. So that's something which works quite well. Then we can define the expectation of a function from the manifold into any vector space. For instance, we can define the expectation of the variance, which is the expectation of the square distance. We can define the information, which is the expectation of the log of the intrinsic density. But one thing we cannot define is the expectation of a random point itself, because in that case we would have an integral from the manifold into a manifold, and an integral is linear and the manifold is not. So that's something we cannot do. So to define the mean value, we need something else. And this, the definition, there are many definitions of mean values, but the one that emerged over time is the one that Fréchet proposed in 1944, and which is to minimize the variance. And actually, in a standard vector space, minimizing the variance, you can do the computation, leads you to the very center, to the mean value. So in the manifold, the idea is that we will minimize the variance, or we can generalize a little bit, we can minimize the expectation of the alpha, well, distance to the alpha, this generalization, and if you take alpha equal 2, you have the mean, alpha equal 1, you have the median that Sarang Joshi presented earlier this week, and alpha equal 0, you're going to the modes. And this is an interesting way to think things, because if you think about the modes of a distribution, there's no way they should be unique. So this is exactly the same thing, but for all the mean values in the manifold, there's no reason why the median or the mean should be unique. So there are theorems, if it's sufficiently concentrated, if the sample of the distribution is sufficiently concentrated with respect to the curvature of the manifold, then we can show that this is unique. But in general, there's no special reason. Okay. So if we think about the fresh mean. So this is a minimization problem. So usually when you have a minimization, we're trying to find what are the critical points, and this gives an implicit definition. And so we can do that also for the mean value, and we have this result, which is that basically if you take the exponential part of the mean point, then in this tangent space, once you have flattened everything, the mean value will be zero, which means that this you have an exponential barycenter. So this is a definition. This means that the standard definition correspond to more or less what we are expecting. So there is just a condition, which is that there should be the measure of the Ketler class should be null. So there are some technical conditions behind. So we have a good characterization of the mean value. Now the key question is how can we reach the mean value? Well, there is this famous Gauss-Newton geodesic marching algorithm, which is very simple. You are at a given point on the manifold, you develop everything on the tangent space, take the mean value in the tangent space, this gives you a new vector, and then you go along the geodesic that starts at the current point with this vector, and you iterate. And actually, this is an algorithm which is more than quadratic, and it's converging in 5 to 10 iterations to the numerical accuracy of the machine generally. And we can show that this algorithm still continues to work even if we don't have exactly the exponential and log map. So we can do approximation in there. This is a very powerful algorithm. Okay, so once we have the mean, we know that at the mean point, if we develop everything in the tangent space, the mean value is the usual mean value. So what about the covariance matrix? Well, we can define it by the usual covariance matrix at the in the tangent space. So we can do higher order also and define higher order moments in that using that framework. So this now we have the moments from if we want to do statistics at some point, we want to do some p-value. We want to have some distribution and do some tests. So the simple distribution that we can think of is the uniform distribution. So of course, in a given compact set, otherwise it's difficult to define. So the uniform density can be defined, or you can think of it basically as the density that is that has a maximal entropy, knowing that you measure the point within your set. And if you try to look at the distribution that realize that this is basically the indicatrix multiplied by the standard measure. So this means that the notion of uniformity is given by the Riemannian measure that we have on the manifold. Now if we want to go to the Gaussian, which is if we are measuring things, we are thinking first Gaussian. The standard way to do would be to define the heat term. So saying that you have a spike and then it's diffusing on the manifold. The problem is that on the manifold, in a vector space, you can rescale the Gaussian by the time of diffusion because it's homogeneous. In a manifold, it's not. So we have the starting point, the arrival point, and the time. So we have one more parameter with respect to usual. So it's difficult to work with that. So there are other definitions. You can think of taking a Gaussian in the tangent space and wrap it around the manifold. But then, from a numerical point of view, we get infinite series in the case of the sphere, and it's difficult to work with that. So one of the things we propose is to change the definition and to say finally, from a computer science point of view, what we have is a mean value and a covariance matrix, and what we would like is to find a distribution that has this mean value and this covariance matrix, but which has maximal entropy, so that we add the minimal amount of information. And if we do that, we can show that the actual distribution that we find is very close to a Gaussian in the tangent space, except that here the concentration matrix is related to the inverse of the covariance matrix with a term which corrects for the curvature. So that's the that's giving a family of distribution that range from direct function to uniform distribution if you are on a compact space. And it's one kind of definition, one kind of generalization of the Gaussian. So then we can go toward Mahalanobis or distance D-square test, which is basically using the distance which we rated by the inverse of the coherence matrix. And this definition still is computed in the tangent space. And what's is interesting is that the expectation for any distribution is the dimension of the manifold. So it seems that there is some kind of regularity that we captured with this kind of definition. And in the case of the Gaussian, then we can compute that it has a chi-square distribution up to the third order in the variance, which means that if the distribution is sufficiently concentrated, basically we can do the statistics as usual. That's the main lesson from this formula. Okay, so just an example of the test on manifolds. This is an example with rigid registrations. So we had a series of images with echo one. These are T2 images, but we have two echo time. And the idea is we're registering images between themselves, between between echo one, and between echo two. And we're also predicting the accuracy of this registration. And to verify that, the idea is that, this transformation should be equal to this one up to the uncertainty that we have on the transformation. So we can we can measure that using a chi-square test to verify are the two transformations the same or not. And actually, if we just test is the transformation between echo one images the same as echo two, the test is rejected. But if we're testing is the composition of these two transformations the same as this one, this is accepted within echo one images, and this is accepted within echo two images. So actually what this means in that case was that although the two images were acquired exactly in the same time without moving, there is something, there is a geometric transformation between echo one and echo two images. And if we try to find what is this transformation, we actually found that there is a bias, a random bias in translation, which is of the order of 0.2 millimeter. I should perhaps say that here the image size is 1 by 1 by 3 millimeter. So this kind of test is able to show that there is a bias of 0.2 millimeter, and actually this corresponds to the amplitude of the chemical shift, because the just some of the parameters of the MR machine were changed to optimize the signal-to-noise ratio. So this is just an example to show that this can be this kind of test can be on manifolds can be quite powerful. Another example with still rigid body transformations in the work of Jonathan Boisvert. The idea is to model the spine. We want to analyze the shape of the spine in scoliotic patients. So the first idea would be to say, okay, we can model hitch vertebra by position orientation in space and do the statistics on that. The problem is that actually this is not really corresponding to an articulated object. If you think about an articulated object, this is actually the articulation between the vertebra, which is the important thing. And this is once again a rigid body transformation, but this is the modeling that we have used here. So here our model is a set of, I think we have 18 rigid body transformations, and we're doing the statistics on that. And here's the mean shape of the vertebra. So this is a spine which does not exist, just the mean. And the variance of all the articulations. So we can analyze that, but it's more interesting to analyze the joint coherence matrix of all the articulation together. And this is actually the result of a PCA on the around the mean value. And we can see the four first mode of variability. So here it's a frontal view, first mode, second mode, third mode, and fourth mode. And here it's a lateral view of the same modes. And what we can see that the first mode, for instance, is associated to growth, but not only to growth, there is also a deformation. So that's also one of the interesting findings. In that case, position of the vertebra was not normalized with respect to the age, because actually scoliosis is linked with the growth of the child. So this is what we're seeing here. There is an augmentation of the scoliosis with the growth. And so it's, well, the other mode could be interpreted. So if we, by discussing with the clinicians, they could see very interesting things in there. From a statistical point of view, what we were able to show that these four modes only were were significantly correlated with the clinical classification. And so this means that the modeling here, which is just using the articulation, statistics on articulation, is really able to capture the information that was in the data. Okay, so let's try now to extend a little bit this statistical framework to image value or manifold valued images. And the idea is, you've seen it quite a few times over the week, this is one of the best examples of manifold valued images, a DTI. You have tensors, positive definite matrices at every point. So if you have a look at the tensor space, it's the positivity is constraint is actually defining a cone in the space of positive matrices. And as it is, while a cone is convex, so any convex operation, the mean doing interpolation between two tensors stays within the cone, so you stay positive defining. However, if you want to do a gradient descent or a PDE for regularization, for instance, then you have many chances to go out of the space and to cross the boundary, which is a new eigenvalue. So the question is, how can we compute more faithfully to stay in this space? And one of the solutions that was proposed by at least four groups about the same time and at this place 4 years ago was to use a defined environment metric. So Christophe Langlais presented it briefly on Tuesday or Wednesday. So the idea is to say, okay, we have some kind of group action. This sigma is a tensor, and we have a group action which corresponds to how a defined transformation is modifying a covariance matrix. And what we're requiring is that the dot product on two tangent space, so two tangent vectors here, so tangent vector to a positive definite symmetric matrix is a symmetric matrix without any constraint. So what we're requiring is that this dot product is invariant by the group action, which means that if we're transporting if we're going from sigma to A sigma A transpose, we're transporting also the tangent vector, and the dot product should not change. So in particular, we can use A, which is the square root of the matrix sigma, and so we can define the dot product at any place from the dot product at the identity. So there are some more technical conditions. For instance, whatever A you choose so that you go back to identity, this should be the same dot product. So this means that the dot product and the identity should be invariant by the isotropic group at that place. And one can show that actually all the dot product, the isotropic group in that case is the rotation group, and all the dot products are Frobenius norm plus something, and there is actually one parameter family of affine environment metrics. But for all this affine environment metric, we have a closed form solution for the exponential for the geodesics. So I didn't write there the equivalent of the reverse map, which is the log. But this is the way we can implement the exponential. So remember that from this exponential map, then we can have most of the operation. We can compute many different things. Okay, a bit later, Vincent Orsini proposed to use the log Euclidean metric. So the idea is very simple. It's if you see that formula, there is an X here, which is the Riemannian exponential map. And on this side, this is the matrix exponential. Actually, the matrix exponential is a diffeomorphism from the space of symmetric matrices to the space of positive definite symmetric matrices. So as we have a diffeomorphism, this means that we have a vector space on symmetric matrices, and we can transport it in the space of positive definite symmetric matrices. And that's the idea of the log Euclidean metric. So in the Riemannian setting, these are the formula. These are not very good looking, but the distance is more interesting. It's basically the standard distance after taking the log. And the the computing framework with the log Euclidean is very simple. You take the log of the tensor, do whatever you want, and come back to the original space after. But to keep in the in this talk, this is the exponential map. So we can use the log Euclidean exactly in the same way as the other metrics to define other extensions. So what would we like to do as operation in images? So one of the first operation is interpolation. I mean, if we have measurements at different points, then we need to know what is the value of the tensor at non-integral points. So if we have two tensors, this one and this one, the standard interpolation is just going along the geodesic that join the two tensors. So this is what it gives for Euclidean. So it's just the interpolation of the values in the tensor. And this is here what's happening with the affine environment metric. So we're going along the geodesic. Now if we have an image, actually we have values at the corner of the voxel here, and we want to have the value at any point inside. So what we are doing usually is to take a bilinear interpolation or bicubic or whatever you want. But the key principle of bilinear interpolation is that we're taking a point here, we're computing how much each of these should contribute, and we are making a weighted mean. And this is exactly the keyword, weighted mean. The mean, we know how to do it by minimization. So here, we can rephrase that problem as finding the tensor which minimizes the distance, or the weighted distance, to the tensor that are at the edge of our pixel or voxel. So here, at each point, we have a minimization problem, but this gives the interpolation. And we can generalize that to other types of smoothing. For instance, Gaussian smoothing. If you take a convolution, that's nothing more than a weighted mean. So we can define convolution or Gaussian smoothing through minimization. So this is an example. This image is the Gaussian smoothing in the Riemannian, using the Riemannian metric. And actually, at each point, we optimize this formula. So using gradient descent, and in 5 to 10 iterations at each point, we're finding the solution. And this gives something which seems to be much better preserving. Well, we have some outliers that take a big weight in the case of tensor that seems to disappear. So what I've shown so far is that one of the ideas when working on manifold is that as soon as you have, usually in your vector space, you have a sum or an integral, then we should try to figure out a way to transform that or to rephrase that as a minimization problem using an intrinsic functional. There are other things that we can try to, we would like to do on images, like regularization. So one of the simplest regularization is try to minimize the L2 norm of the gradient, and the gradient of the tensor field here is, the gradient of the tensor field is a matrix. And the only difference with respect to the standard Euclidean case is that we have to be careful that we are at a given point. So we should take the norm, the Riemannian norm, and not the Euclidean norm. And if we do that, we can show that the derivative of that regularization is the Laplacian, but the manifold Laplacian. So it takes into account the curvature. And in that case, we can then use try to tweak this this Laplacian to get some anisotropic filtering, for instance, using the paranormalic equation that was used also by Guido Gehrig a long time ago, or to do robust functional, robust phi functions to have something which is an anisotropic filtering. The key thing here, I won't enter into the details, but the key thing is that we can still implement the Laplacian without, we don't need to compute the curvature modification of the Laplacian, because the exponential map gives us a numerical scheme to compute it, to compute this manifold Laplacian without without any problem. So this scheme here is automatically computing the Laplacian as it should. So this is one of the interests. If you have, once again, if you have the exponential map, then you can compute all these things and do some anisotropic diffusion. So this is an example where we can see that the tensor here are much better preserved, while the interface between the ventricles and this this fiber tract is well preserved, and even the U shape here is preserved. Okay, so then we can continue, and we've developed a few things. So Pierre Fillard worked on tractography and is still working on that now. We've done some work also on the heart, doing some, this is an anatomical model of the fibers of the heart, so we can do some statistics on the tensors in that case. And this is the result where we have the fiber corresponding to the mean tensor in the heart, and we were able to show that this the orientations actually in the heart, the orientation of the fibers and on the sheets are very stable. Okay, so I think it's time to go back to the original problem, which was the morphometry of the brain. So I'm kind of leaving my theoretical hat of how to do statistics, well-grounded statistics, and now we're entering more into practical work, which is how to try to get some results on the brain. Okay, and so the two things that I will show in this section is, the first part is using curves, and the second part will be using statistics on transformations. So the first thing we do is a collaboration that we have for a long time with Paul and Deloney here. And we used a data set of 72 circle lines that were manually delineated on many subjects. So you can see some examples of these circle lines here. Of course, the idea is to use Infine, an automatic extraction. For instance, the circle surfaces that can be extracted automatically by Brain Visa, by Jean-François Mangin and his team. But for the moment, we prefer to stay on this one, because these are basically the anatomical reference. So we don't need to argue about, is it right or false? This is, for us as computer scientists, is the reference of the neuroscientist. Okay, so the principle of what we did is the following. For each subject, we have, for each line, here we have the Sylvian Fisher, and in light blue, you can see the lines of the 72 subjects. So this is actually a whole plate of spaghetti, and we're trying to find the mean spaghetti within that. And the way to do that is to try to find a curve that is minimizing the distance with respect to all the others. And the distance is just the, we just took something very simple, the Euclidean distance, but we keep the an order preserving mapping between the mean curve and each of the instance. And actually the idea is, the algorithm is very simple. You start from a curve, compute the correspondence with all of the curves, which gives you, you can recompute the position of the mean value and iterate this scheme. So that's exactly the same scheme as I explained before. For computing the mean, you have to iterate. And so we ended up with a mean curve, which is hidden there, but you can see the red curves are the mean curves for all the SERCI. And as we have the correspondences, we can display second order modeling of this variability, which is a covariance matrix. And this is the covariance matrix of the mapping to all the curves. And here the tensor is represented at 1 sigma so that you can still see the curves. So this is representing the variability, actually, of all the circle lines with respect to the mean one. And we have not only, the color here is representing the amount of variability, the trace of the covariance matrix, but we also have some kind of orientation. And this is given by the tensor. So the next step is we have this information only along the mean circle lines. And we would like to have this information over the whole brain. So the idea is to try to extrapolate that information so that we can use it everywhere. And to extrapolate that, what we did is to you a diffusion. So it's basically this term is a data attachment term. We want the field of covariance matrix to be very close to the measures that we have here. But when we don't have measure, we want to have a very low gradient. So we're trying to minimize the gradient while sticking at the measured value. And this is a view of what it gives.
So if it's turning, it's much more prettier when it's turning.
Okay. And so, but this is a measurement. So we first tried to figure out is it more or less correct or not. So we compared it with a previous experiment of Paul Thompson, where actually the correspondences between the brains were measured by mapping the surfaces. So these are completely different features that were used to compute the variability. And what we can observe is that globally we have the same high variability in the area which are highly specialized, and we have a low variability in the phylogenetically older area. So it's just seems to mean that we're not measuring we're measuring something consistent. So more recently we tried to go a bit further in this analysis. And so far what we had is just the covariance matrix of each point at the mean circle line. Now what is interesting is also to know if a point is moving between quotes, because we are in between subject, but if a point is moving in one direction, how are the other point moving? Is there a correlation between two different points? And this is what we've done here. We took here this point as a reference, and the color is a test which tells how correlated are the motion of the other point. And what you can see that around the reference point, of course there is a correlation, which means that somehow the brain is moving in a continuous way. But what is more interesting is that we have a correlation also at the symmetric point. And what was completely unexpected is this thing there, which is telling us that there is a correlation in the frontal lobe with respect to this point. So I don't know what it means. We are just in the first step of what I was saying at the beginning, discovering things. Now we need to explain them. Okay, we can go we can try to do other type of experiments. So that's an experiment we did on the where we were trying to investigate the difference in symmetry between groups. And that's actually what we can see here is, well, it's the difference of variability between symmetric points. So it's kind of difficult to interpret, but what we can see there without entering into the neural anatomical interpretation is that there is a big difference between men and women. But we already know that there is a difference. So, okay. So, in the same time we were doing this correlation analysis to find out somehow the green kernel of the deformation, we tried to uh, uh, to to use the same data but to change the methods to see if the results were still valid. And so with standard development, we use a method which is basically trying to match the lines using a distance which is based on the currents with a diffeomorphism, which is a whole deformation of the space. And this gives, this is the variability that we're measuring. So in that case, it's not exactly the same type of variability. Before it was the variability as the vector field of this, the displacement field. Here it's the variability of the initial tangent vector of the diffeomorphism. And it gives a map which seems to be, which seems to agree in some of the places and not really in others. So we can analyze that. So we'll refer you to Stanley if you want to know more about this analysis. What is more interesting is that with this modeling, we can have also a generative model. And this is an example of a whole the population of the first two modes of variability that we can extract. This is actually the diffeomorphism which is applied to a surface of the cortex. And we can see how it deforms along the different brains.
Well, in the mean for the population. Okay, so this brings me to the last point of my talk, which is how to do statistics on nonlinear transformations. So the first thing, message I would like to tell about that is, okay, statistics on deformation, but what for? For what purpose? And I can see two different purposes. One is, discovering what is the variability of the brain. And I think for that we need to have many different methods and to compare the methods, because as we've seen with the two methods, one the method of Pierre Fillard and the method of Stanley, there are some differences. So the results do agree at some place but do disagree at other places, so which is right. So each method has different assumptions which are reflected in the results. And we need to be able to we need several methods to analyze what is good and what is not. And I believe that it's only if all the methods agree within their domain of validity that we can say, okay, there is indeed something happening there. So that's the first way to see things, which is trying to make, to use different methods and to discover truths by consensus. The second use of variability is more oriented toward medical image analysis, is for personalization. It's actually, can we use that variability as a prior to better deform an atlas toward a given brain? And that's something which is important for us in some applications, like in that case, conformal radiotherapy. In radiotherapy, the radiotherapist segments the tumor. This is his duty to finally delineate where is the tumor and how we should irradiate within the tumor. But we should maximize the dose within the tumor, but we should also minimize it in certain critical regions. For example, the optic nerve is very sensitive to radiation, so we want to avoid it. So we need to segment the other structures. And one of the ideas, why don't we use an atlas and try to deform it toward the patient? The key problem is that the patient in brain cancer often had already a surgery. So in that case, here you can see that there was part of the brain which was already removed. So there are some things which are not in the atlas. So we need to take that into account in the algorithms. And we need to deform correctly at the place where there are where the brain is normal, and not to take into account the tumors or the pathologies. Okay, so how to deform correctly? What's the good regularization criterion? So that's the question that Natasha did address in the previous talk.
My point of view is that, well, if we have a quick review of the literature, there are some physically based registrations, so some kind of elastic or fluid criterion. I placed LDDMM and rate invariant metrics on diffeomorphism in physically because there is some correlation with mechanics. On the other hand, there are many algorithms which were developed in medical image analysis which are efficient, very efficient from a computational point of view, but which have no physical grounding. For instance, Gaussian filtering in the demons, and we later this kind of Gaussian filtering was later extended to non-stationary Gaussian filtering by Lester and non-stationary and anisotropic by Stefanescu. So in the case of a patient which would evolve over time, we could conceive that there could be a model of evolution of the brain and there is a physical deformation. But if we're comparing the brain of two different subjects, why should it be physical? I mean, the only physical model that you can see is, okay, wrap back or undo the growing up to the fetus stage and then grow back to someone else. So in that case, even diffeomorphism can be questioned. So I think the idea is more that we should try to learn statistically what is the regularization criterion, or in terms of Riemannian geometry, what is the kernel, the famous L or K that we've seen this week. How should it be? Can we learn it from a population? So here's an experiment that we did to try this idea. Here's an atlas. We have a database of images. So we first did an affine registration, then an elastic between court registration, that's a demon-like registration. And we've got a field of deformations for all the subjects. And now on all this population of deformation, we did some kind of robust statistics on the deformation tensors, which are represented here. And we used this statistics on deformation to reintroduce them in the algorithm, to drive actually the regularization, to modify the regularization in an isotropic way here, and in an anisotropic way here. And what we can see is, with respect to the standard algorithm, in that case in the atlas, you don't have this black white dot here, which is due to a residue of the gadolinium, which was injected previously. So the registration gets stuck at this point. With scalar statistics, it's already better, seems to be smoother, but we're still stuck by this thing, which was not in the original image. And with these anisotropic statistics on the deformation, we're able to go over and to recover a quite good registration segmentation, atlas-based segmentation of this subject. Okay, so what I tried to do then was trying to formalize that from a mathematical point of view. And one of the ideas, if we're doing statistics on the deformation, then we should be able to reuse them in the same statistical framework. And the way to do that is was to observe that in mechanics, we are using this train tensor, which is basically the Jacobian matrix of the transformation, transpose Jacobian matrix of the transformation. And this tensor is a positive definite matrix. It's positive definite because there's no singularity in the deformation. And it's close to identity where it's locally a rotation. And it's the eigenvalues are greater than one if you have an expansion and smaller than one if you have a contraction. The key problem if we are using that in the this is the standard elastic energy. The key problem here, we are measuring how the strain tensor is different from the identity. But if you have a look at that, if you take sigma equals zero, which is black hole transformation, it's at the same distance as sigma equal 2 from the identity. So basically you have a problem which is asymmetric, where you're favoring some of the transformation. And for the statistics, we know that it's difficult to do statistics on tensors. So one of the idea was, as we did in other for tensors, we have a positive definite matrix, take the log, and now we have a symmetric matrix on which we can do the statistics. And actually, if we are doing that, the log of the strain tensor is known in mechanics as a Hankey strain tensor, and it's used for highly deformable materials. And so the idea is we're computing so the log of the strain tensor, computing the mean value, the covariance matrix, and then we can use, as for creating a regularization criterion, we can use the Mahalanobis distance. So it's basically, we will try to reweight the deformability according to the covariance matrix that we observe locally. And this is basically how we can write it. And if we look for all the isotropic version of that statistical formula, then we find this regularization criterion. And as you can see, it's very close to the standard elasticity. And even if you do a Taylor expansion, actually, of the log, we can show that this is these are equivalent up to the first order. So it's just a nonlinear version of elasticity that can be used. Okay, and one slide that Natasha didn't show, but I find very interesting, is that if we're using that Riemannian elasticity measure to try to measure the distance between monozygotic and dizygotic twins, what we can see is here in blue, this is the distance between one given twin and all the other, well, this is the distance between one guy and all the others, and in blue it's the distance with respect to the identical twin. And what we can see is that it seems that the distance to the monozygotic twin is always the shortest, so it seems to be anatomically valid to use that kind of measurements. Okay, so I will just finish this part on a few questions, which is basically I've shown you a few ways to do statistics on deformations, but there are actually many others. And so we've seen statistics on local deformation based on some mechanical ideas. There are, in medical image analysis, there are statistics on the displacement fields or on the baseline parameters for now quite a few years. You could do the statistics on the space of initial momentum. And there is also a new way of doing statistics, which was proposed by Vincent Arsini, which was to take actually the log, between quote, of the diffeomorphism. And in that case, you have a very simple framework also to do statistics on diffeomorphisms, and it's very efficient. So in all cases, we will have different statistics. And one of the questions, I think, which is open for the future is, which one should we do, which one is more powerful, how could we compare all these methods to do statistics on deformations. Okay. So just a wrap up of what I tried to say in this talk about computing a manifold. The idea is that the Riemannian metric is giving us somehow the measure with which we can do some probability. We can do a few tools, but if we want to reinterpret most of the tools, then we have to rewrite the equation as minimizations. So that's the first type of tool that we can do. And the second main idea is that the exponential map is the basic algorithmic brick that we need to implement. And from there, we can do many many different things like geodesic gradient descent and Laplace-Beltrami and everything. So I hope that I've shown you that this is a mathematically powerful way to do statistics for medical imaging applications. One of the questions that I still have is I've shown you everything about Riemannian geometry, but is that the minimal structure that we can use to do statistics? And one of the problems, for instance, if we are doing statistics on transformations, if you do statistics on rigid body transformations, you take three rigid body transformations, compute the mean with the left invariant metric, for instance, and you take the inverse of these transformations, and the mean of the inverse is not the inverse of the mean. So which means that, in general, there is no left and right invariant metric, so we cannot have statistical values like mean, coherence matrix, which are completely consistent with the group operation. So could we use other type of structure, like perhaps the symmetric Cartan connection? I don't know, that's an open issue, changing the structure on which we can rebuild all this kind of statistics. Okay, so more practically, I think we've heard quite a lot this week about infinite dimensional manifolds. One of the questions that myself I have is how to do an efficient implementation from the computational point of view of all that. And I think that there might be interesting ways to speed up significantly LDDMM methods by doing some kind of approximation. And Stanley Villeneuve will present a paper at NICAI, which is on currents, but where the idea is to try to approximate the currents by a very low number of points. And actually, I think the same kind of ideas could be used to get way faster for LDDMM methods. And the last message is more about learning the metric. What kind of method can we design to learn the metric of the deformation? Okay, so from the more application point of view, I also think that we should try to build anatomical model from many different sources, and that if we have curves that is giving us only a part, a very small part, very partial view of the variability, so we need to use curves, we need to use statistics on the surface of the brain, we need to use statistics on the DTI, on the tracks, and we need to try to combine all that to really understand what is the real variability of the brain. And I hope that in the future, this will give rise to many applications in neuroscience, but also in personalized medicine, which is more the type of application that I'm looking at. So just a few thanks to many of the people that worked on the different images that are presented, and a short announcement for the part of the method I showed are implemented in the freeware that we are distributing. The next one, there will be a new release. There is already the diffeomorphic daemons in that software, but next month there will be the diffeomorphic DTI registration that will be presented at MICAI in September. So it normally should be available in August. Thank you very much.
Well, that was an excellent talk, Xavier. Questions?
That's a good question. Actually,
Xavier, could you repeat the question?
Okay. So the question was, when we estimate a kernel for the metric, what is the smoothness of a space? And actually, what we've done, so I don't have the movie of Pierre. Oops. The only estimation we did is this one. And so what we can look at is how it varies when we vary the reference point, and it seems to be quite regular. But the key thing is, this is all, you should not forget that we have data only on the circle lines, so it's already smooth. So the estimation we have is already smooth, but I think the way to go is to have some kind of simple model, for instance, saying that there is a kind of Gaussian, and we just have the way, the standard deviation to adapt, and it should vary smoothly. And to fit that model, then to add some long distance correlations, which is something that is not in the all the kernels that we're using. Nobody's using long distance correlations in the kernels. So that's something I believe that should be more and should bring some additional knowledge for better deforming. But I don't have really an answer. I think we have to impose some kind of smoothness, otherwise the data will give us some very crazy thing. So I think we should have to smooth, but in a kind of way we know how we smooth and we understand what is the process, what is the model which is behind.
So I'm sort of trying to understand exactly what it means to be doing tensor interpolation in the long Euclidean space. If you look at the geodesic walking in 1D, I can picture places where that would be the appropriate way to do it. For example, if you're interpolating between two neighboring pixels, two neighboring voxels that had crossing fibers, then in between that you'd expect a sort of a volume averaging, and you'd expect to get the results you see in the geodesic walking image there. So which uses of interpolation is the log Euclidean form more appropriate for?
Not sure to capture exactly your question. In that case, it's not exactly log Euclidean, it's a fine invariant, but the log Euclidean is almost the same.
In which situations would you choose to use that interpolation rather than the geodesic walking interpolation?
Well, it's just the geodesic walking is only between two points. You cannot do geodesic between three points. So it's actually, it turns out that if you have only two points, this interpolation comes down to the geodesic walking. So it's exactly the same setup. If you're minimizing that with two points, you end up with the equation above. So it's a kind of, it's one generalization, but it's the number of points that you have which fixed actually the method that you can use.
Other questions? Thanks again for